From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Dr. Karen Smith of the California Department of Public Health talks about reducing our nation's health disparities. Comedian Jordan Peele discusses his horror hit film, Get Out. And classical violinist Nicola Benedetti sits down for a career conversation. But first, in President Trump's recent address, his first one, in fact, to a joint session of Congress, he laid out his case for his administration's agenda. Yet there are many who are concerned about the long-term implications of his plans. Our next guest, David Frum, is the senior editor of The Atlantic and the former speechwriter for George W. Bush. He has written the cover story for the magazine. It's called How to Build an Autocracy. In the article, he outlines how America could potentially go from being, quote, democratic to autocratic, close quote, under this administration. He joins us now from Washington. David, good to have you back on the program, sir.
Thank you so much for your hospitality.
So we're not calling it a State of the Union address, or the White House isn't calling it that, right. But it is his first address to a joint session of Congress. Why make that distinction?
It's very traditional in the first year of a presidency not to call the first speech a State of the Union, simply because the new president has been in office such a short time. So it's not really a backward look. It's a forward look. That's the way it was under President Obama. That's the way it was under President George W. Bush. President Trump is trying to present an image of a country that's in disarray. It's a scene of carnage. That's been his theme because he wants to lower the baseline. If Americans think too hard about the prosperity and success of the country right now, it makes it hard for him to take credit later for everything. You saw that President Trump tweeted out that the national debt had gone down $12 billion in his first month in office. That's actually kind of fake math, and it refers to just normal fluctuations within governmental accounts. But if it were true, which it wasn't, but if it were true, it would reflect not his policies, none of which are in effect, but he's going to want to take credit looking backwards as well as for any good news that happens going forwards.
So when do you think he starts to make the shift? Because I think it's fair to say that this kind of negativity, and for lack of a better word, can only go on so long. People don't want to keep waking up every day and being scared to death by another CNN alert. So even if that is his strategy, how long can he run that play?
The time, as you say, for that play is out. But people need to keep in mind, and this is a theme I've been stressing pretty hard. As you said, I worked for George W. Bush. I'm pretty proud of that service. I voted for Mitt Romney in 2012. I am a pretty conservative Republican. What the issue ahead of the country is not about those kinds of politics anymore. Donald Trump's goal is not to, he may end up doing some kind of Republican things, but that's not what he's in office for. He's in office to make himself the richest man on the planet, and he's in office to break whatever restraints there are on the office of the presidency on his way to getting to be the richest man on the planet.
You think it's that simple, that straightforward?
I think it's not that simple, but it is that straightforward. Donald Trump has turned off their whole series of mechanisms we have to keep an eye on what the president is up to. One of the most important of those mechanisms is the release of tax returns. Every president has done it since Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford didn't release all of his tax returns, but a lot of them. Then Jimmy Carter released the whole thing, and every president since then has done it every year, as has every candidate for president. Even Mitt Romney, who didn't want to, eventually did do it. There's a standard disclosure form that everybody who works in the executive branch has to fill out. I filled it out. It's not very informative about the kinds of finances that a man like Donald Trump would have. If Donald Trump is richer today than he was the day before the election, there is no way to know. And if he is a year from now, if he's richer again, there's no way to know. And there's certainly no way to know if his children and his son-in-law are dramatically richer today than they were a month ago. We know all of them, however, do a lot of business outside the country. And we know from periodic glimpses, we get little visions of what's going on in Uruguay, in India, in Argentina. And meanwhile, what we also see is a lot of the norms and habits that are used, that our federal government has had since the Carter era, are being turned off.
There is no president, at least in my lifetime, David, who did not get richer as a result of his having been the president. That's in part what got Hillary and Bill Clinton into trouble this time around when she ran. God knows how much money Barack Obama and Michelle are going to make from their books, not to mention speeches, et cetera, et cetera. So we've come to accept the fact that presidents are going to enrich themselves when they're out of office. So I don't frankly begrudge Mr. Trump being richer when he leaves than he is now. The question is whether or not those checks and balances that are in place to stop him from doing that on our backs are going to work. Are they going to work?
Wait a minute. Let's distinguish between two things. Yeah, presidents make money after they leave office. Why not? It's America. Americans like to make money. And if they make money in honest ways, whether by the books they write or businesses they join.
Or the speeches they give to Goldman Sachs and other places?
Yeah, I love that a little bit less because that looks like the sale of axes. This is all pretty new. Remember, the first president of the United States ever to give a speech for money after leaving office was President Ford. I remember that. It was a big scandal. Before that, they didn't do it. But whatever you think about the way they get rich after office, President Obama was poorer on the day he left office than he was on the day he entered office. Bill and Hillary Clinton were certainly poorer on the day they left office than the day they entered. George W. Bush, poorer on the day he left because you live on your salary. Presidents have to buy their own groceries and things like that. They have a lot of demands on them, and they spend down their assets knowing they can recoup later. To get rich in office and to get rich while you're running a business, and not because, hey, Ronald Reagan got richer when he was in office. He put his money in stocks at the beginning of his presidency, looked the other way, put it in the hands of a broker, and the broker made his portfolio better by the end. Reagan had nothing to do with it. Everyone in the stock market had more money at the end of the Reagan presidency than at the beginning. Donald Trump is running a business, and his family is running a business, and they are selling access as we speak, and that is absolutely unheard of. I've talked too long here, but just want to say one more thing. There's a kind of easy cynicism that a lot of younger people have, that they all lie, they're all crooked, they're all the same. And I can tell, I've spent my life around politicians, the cynicism is wrong. And you suddenly realize why, in a Donald Trump time, why it's dangerous. Because when you do meet somebody who does those things, you aren't shocked. And one of the things that is going to be a struggle for everybody during the Trump presidency is to stay shocked every day because what's happening is really shocking.
I take your point, and I'm glad you said that. But there is a distinct difference, as you know, between cynicism and skepticism. And quite frankly, he's pushing the envelope on both of those things. I hear you loud and clear about cynicism, but he's giving reasons, plural, every day for people to engage in skepticism. And I think we're getting more of that, quite frankly, than we're getting from the cynicism crowd.
Well, yeah. I mean, people have to step up and they have to be engaged. You have to demand more and demand better. And I think that's one of the themes of the article I wrote.
Right.
And what I try to do in this article, a lot of people have kind of very vivid, lurid ideas of what it means to lose your freedom. They think, they're going to be federal jackbooted stormtroopers. That's not how it works in the modern state. We live in an age of democratic decline. There are fewer democracies in the world today than there were in 2005, and many of the countries that remain democracies are losing their democratic character. Think of Hungary right now. Think of Poland. Think of the Philippines. Think of post-Mandela South Africa. You can see there's less freedom of the press. The judiciary is more corrupt. But elections don't stop. And it's not like Putin's Russia. They don't murder people. They don't even usually wrongfully arrest people. They just use a lot of deceit and corruption, and they make political checks and balances less meaningful. That's the future I fear for the United States under Donald Trump.
So I guess the question is whether or not in the era of Trump we are going to become, he will force us to become, coerce us to become better citizens. Yes, no?
That's such an important question. I'm not going to make a prediction. I'm going to offer encouragement. One of the things that I keep saying in the article, people may remember the story of Ebenezer Scrooge, The Christmas Carol. When he sees the third ghost, the ghost of Christmas future, he asks the ghost, "Are you the vision of things that will be, or of things that could be?" And the ghost never answers him, but it becomes clear this is just a future. Mm-hmm. You can choose your own. You look at a lot of the groups that, on the raw data, you'd think would be vulnerable to Donald Trump. Groups like Mormons, tend to have less education than other groups and a little lower income than other groups. You would think that Mormons would be very vulnerable, and yet they were one of the most resistant groups to Donald Trump. Why? Because they were connected. They had they're joiners. They belong to things. Same way with some of the Protestant churches in areas like central Wisconsin. Where people belong, they are less vulnerable to Donald Trump. So be a belonger. Join the choir. It'll Trump-proof you and your neighbors if you are involved in some kind of civic activity.
Whatever is to come, David, how complicit will Republicans be when the historians look back on this Trump era?
Well, that's a heavy question and a painful question. The place where we check and balance the president is in Congress. I have total confidence in the courts, but the federal courts, there aren't that many of them. They're very slow. They only hear certain kinds of questions. And they can never start initiate anything. They wait for people to bring problems to them. And then they'll do justice, I'm sure, the same as they always do. But Congress is the place where it happens. And Congress has been lying down for this president on everything from conflict of interest to the tax returns. And now to the most, to what is my mind, I mean, different people have different views, the most horrible thing, which is that this president and his people look, we don't know this, but it looks like they were colluding with a hostile foreign power to influence an American election. If that is the way some suggest, and we don't know that, I want to really emphasize, don't let, we have to be careful not to get ahead of the story, but it would be one of the worst scandals in American history.
Do the Democrats, very quickly, David, have any other option other than obstructionism, which they accused the Republicans of doing during the Obama era?
Well, I'm not a Democrat, but I'd advise them to pick their fights. Don't fight everything. If you see this guy acting like a normal Republican, I mean, you've got your views, of course, but the places to be the most careful about are the things that no other person would do. The Russia stuff, the corruption stuff, the abuse of office, things that if Mitt Romney were president would not be happening. And the things that would be happening if Mitt Romney were president, that sort of normal politics, let's clean up the government and then deal with normal politics.
David Frum, good to have you back on, my friend.
Thank you very much.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Everyone deserves an opportunity to live a healthy life, but disparities in health and health care are big obstacles to improving the nation's overall health. Dr. Karen Smith is the director of the California Department of Public Health and the state's top public health official. She joins us now to talk about the challenges and successes in reducing health disparities. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
What do we know? Is it too soon to tell about whether or not we are seeing a leveling of the playing field in terms of health equity because of Obamacare, or too soon to tell?
Well, I think it's a little too soon to tell overall, but there are areas where we know that we have actually made improvements. For example, many more people have health insurance, and especially people in vulnerable communities. That means that they've got doctors that see them over time. It means they don't have to come to the emergency department. That means their health is better, and we overall save money in the system, and that's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. But health coverage, to my mind, you're the expert here, health coverage, to my mind, is not the same as health equity. What's the relationship between the two?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Health equity. Well, let me start with health coverage, right? Without health coverage and access to really good quality health care, they're not the same, access and coverage. Mm-hmm. But when you have, even when you have both, that's really important. In fact, it's essential, but it isn't enough. We also have to be able to live in environments that make it possible, that offer the opportunities to be truly healthy. And that you can't get in a doctor's office. You have to get that by living in a healthy community where you have opportunities to get a really good education, eat good food, be active, all the things that we know go into actually, especially for children, being able to learn and grow and be healthy in the long term, but also for adults.
But since folk can't obviously just up and move, do I take your comment to mean that we are never going to achieve health equity in this country?
I think it's a pretty big climb, but I don't think never is true either. It, just because people can't move doesn't mean that we can't do very real things to improve the areas in which they live by improving the educational system, by really taking a serious look at violence and what violence does to kids and communities, all the other sort of issues that are barriers to people being healthy. Just the way we plan communities, when we make changes, instead of building in the same way we've always built, you know, little subdivision here, little subdivision there, with no access to good services, et cetera, we need to really be thoughtful about what we do. In California, we have a task force that's at the administration level called the Health in All Policies Task Force. And what that task force does is to look at every public policy that we're putting forward and say, does this have a positive impact on health, or negative impact on health. And that's true whether we're talking about transportation planning, land use, et cetera. So everything that we do, particularly those of us who work in the public sector, when we make policy decisions, we're actually making health decisions even if we don't recognize it.
Disabuse me of this notion if you can.
Sure.
But why should I believe that the folk in Washington, for example, care about health equity if they're fighting a frontline battle now against health care?
I don't think that they perceive what they're doing as fighting a battle against health care. Mm-hmm. I think that what they have are certain values that speak to smaller government, more investment in private sector health care. And so they're trying to change the system so that it's less government and more private sector. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a difficult transition because one of the characteristics of the private sector is it's not one entity, it's mm-hmm. many entities. And it's difficult to create a system that works for everybody when you have a lot of different moving parts, which is what we essentially still have actually in the United yeah. States.
So for a lot of people, I don't believe in blanket statements, but mm-hmm. for a lot of people, privatization is the enemy. Mm-hmm. Is privatization the enemy of health equity?
No, I don't think it is. I think that unrestrained privatization where the only goal is to make money for the investor, that's a very difficult mm-hmm. thing to bring into balance with actually being good for the people who are being served. There's a challenge to working in the private sector and actually providing really good services, mm-hmm. but also serving the people who are investing in you. So I think it's actually harder for the private sector to do that. The flip side is that in the public sector, because of the constraints of government and the fact that, frankly, we are spending the taxpayers' dollars, we have to spend a lot of attention and time thinking about, is every single thing that we're doing working? And we create large bureaucracies to kind of monitor that. Mm-hmm. And so that's its own challenge.
When I think of this conversation about health equity, I think, Dr. Smith, of the same kind of conversation that we're having in the education arena, which is this notion of how you get to educational equity mm-hmm. if you're barely achieving educational equality.
Right.
And I think of the same thing when I think of health. It's one thing to have as a goal, you know, health equality. Everybody mm-hmm. deserves equal access to high quality health care. That's equality.
Right.
But equity suggests to me that you have to meet people where they are. It means that some people are going to need more because they deserve more because their condition is more catastrophic. And that sometimes, I think, to some Americans seems anti-American, that some would get more because of their need. So how do you get to equity if you can't ultimately tackle equality? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with you in particular about the equity piece.
Right.
It really is about giving people what they need so that everybody rises
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, not everybody the same
We're
thing.
Not, no, because
exactly.
of
yeah.
course, if I'm in a wheelchair, I'm not going to be able to do the same things
well,
that I can
the,
do
or if, you, or if you're in one of those neighborhoods you spoke of
exactly.
earlier. That's not equality, that's about equity.
Exactly.
This neighborhood needs more, but I'm just trying to see where the political will is to talk about and to advance a notion of health equity if we're not even serious about equality.
Well, that's a really interesting question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I have an answer for it, mm-hmm. but I do think there's a tension there. Americans have been told we're all equal. It's mm-hmm. it's written in
our
the
documents.
Constitution.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that an absolute definition of equal, as you said, which is everybody gets exactly the same thing, is never going to get us to true equity, where mm-hmm. everybody has the same opportunity. And I think that from my perspective, that's actually what the original documents were intended to say, is mm-hmm. that we should all have the same opportunity. Yes, there's a role for personal decision-making and choices, no question, and for personal responsibility. But if you're starting from a huge deficit of resources and access to decent wages and housing that doesn't make you sick and transportation to good jobs and an educational system that actually provides you what you need mm-hmm. to learn, then you're going to need a whole lot more to have the same opportunity.
What is, to your mind, the link between equity and not opportunity, mm-hmm. but equity and responsibility, equity and choice,
right.
the choices that we make?
Well, the truth is people's choices are constrained by their circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the same choices. If you're a single mom whose husband is gone, not in the picture, you can't get a job because you can't get child care.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take care of your child. You're being demonized by members of your community because you're a single mom, and often because you're a person of color. You can't get there You don't have the same choices. Similarly, if you live in a rural community, if you're somebody who's white and you live in a very distant place and you have to travel 5-6 miles to get to a grocery store, you don't have the same opportunity to buy healthy food. And if that grocery store sells that healthy food at a premium, you're not going to have, even if you can get there, you're not going to have the same opportunity.
Yeah. I've been reading, at least, and you run this, so it's a compliment to you, I guess, but I've been reading that California is doing better than most states at adopting the challenge, accepting the challenge of Obamacare to make sure that Californians are healthy. What is it, assuming that you want to brag about this or boast for a second, what is it that California is doing that the rest of the country could learn from and do better on providing health care for all?
Well, one of the things that California did was to expand Medi-Cal, our Medicaid, earlier and more than many states did. And that was very intentional. It required a lot of investment of state money along with the federal money. But it also provided access to folks who would not otherwise have gotten access sooner. We also adopted a model that with the health exchange, we created our own exchange, which gave us flexibility in what we did, that actually looks a lot like the Massachusetts model that Romney put in place when he was governor there. And so we have a balance of, yes, we have expanded Medicaid for the poor, but we also have an exchange for those folks who, they don't qualify as poor, but we have, you know, supplements that we give, additional funding that we give to folks who aren't quite there, but aren't actually able to afford health insurance itself. And so we make coverage possible for a much broader spectrum of people. The other thing that California has done is take advantage of the opportunities provided to us for what are called the Medicaid waivers. That means that we negotiate with the federal government saying, we want to try these models and see if we can get better health for less cost. Yeah. The barriers, that the real life barriers that people face are really very high. And physicians don't necessarily, or nurse practitioners don't really necessarily know what those are. Yeah. And so bringing them closer together, we're going to get better health outcomes, and we're actually going to save money in the long term.
The challenges of health equity, hence this segment that we do periodically called Road to Health. Our guest, the top health official in California, Dr. Karen Smith. Dr. Smith, thanks for your work. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
All this month, we're asking listeners like you to recommend a podcast to someone. All you have to do is tell someone in your life, a friend, your mom, anyone, about a podcast you think they'd love. And if they don't know about podcasts, well, show them how. Then tell us what you recommended using the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. And thank you for spreading the word. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Jordan Peele is best known for his work on the Emmy Award-winning Comedy Central show, Key and Peele. The show ended back in 2015, but Jordan has been busy working on several projects, including a new horror film. It's called Get Out. The project has been described as brilliantly subversive and topped the box office just days after its release. Before we start our conversation with Mr. Peele, first a look at Get Out.
Good to see another brother around here.
Yes, of course it is. Something wrong?
There you are. Do something with this.
Yes.
Oh, hello. I'm Philomena, and you are?
Chris, Rose's boyfriend. Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
That's nice.
I fell out when I saw that was a funny scene. I'm honored to have you on the program. Congrats on being number one.
Thank you.
I brought my thing to get you to sign. This is my
my movie ticket. The studios are very nice to me. They usually send me a private screener so I can sit at my house and watch the movie before the guest comes on the show. But horror films are like things you must see with crowds.
That's right.
So I went to Culver City to see this.
I love it.
And I loved it.
It's, you know, it's like, it's one of the ways it's related to comedy as an art form. It's collaborative, you know, as an audience, it's exponentially improved by getting to have it as a communal experience.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I love that I keep hearing from people is after the film, the whole audience felt closer or like familial, whether it's, you know, mixed or predominantly, you know, one group or the other, there's something communal about the experience of this movie, which is so...
The crowd that I saw with was mixed, and which is always fascinating for me, as if you were there to hear this, they break out into applause. The film ends and the credits start and they start applauding, like, okay, I'll tell Jordan y'all said that when I see him.
It's so great, and you know, the premise of the movie is, on paper, it's a divisive idea, right? You know, most of the white people in this movie are the villains, So I think the greatest feat that we pulled off with this one is creating something that doesn't talk down to the audience, that honors the audience and says, look, I'm giving you credit that you are intelligent, you are an empathetic person, you are human. So at a certain point, that's the power of story, is we can show the perspective of a different human being's experience.
It is, Jordan, the power of story, but there is a risk, I would think, whenever you do a film where you make the white people the villains, and yet white people spend their money to go see the movie. How'd you pull that trick off?
Well, you know, it really was just taking care of the reality of it. The scene that this follows is this party sequence that seems to resonate with a lot of people and put everybody on a similar page, where, you know, we see these connections that, you know, Chris is he's the only black guy at this party until he runs into Logan. But he's approached by white people who are trying to make their connection with him, their black connection with him. This is a dynamic every black person knows.
I understand that.
And many other, every other minority group or someone, you know, who's been in the other category knows. A lot of white people are woke too, but some white people are coming like, oh my God, is this a thing? Oh my God, have I done this? And so getting everybody on the same page as to a really grounded part of the African-American experience, it does just that. It gets us all on the same page.
Yeah. There were so many moments in this film where if you are black, you relate to those experiences. You get this, particularly his boy telling him, do not go to your white girlfriend's house. I would not do that. You were going home to meet her parents. You're doing what? I mean, it was just, you sit there and you laugh because it's funny, but it's rooted, is my friend Maya Angelou would always say, it's as real as rain. And you relate to it.
You know, things, if something rings true, it just does. And it's really worked. I mean, I think it's part of the reason Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was some of the jumping off point to this movie, basically the premise. Even down to the fact, you know, where Sidney Poitier, asks his girlfriend, do they know? It's the first scene in the movie. And she says, no, why? And so I really took that. And part of the reason is because there is something universal about everybody can relate to the fear of going to meet your potential in-laws for the first time. There's an extra added dynamic to that when you have this interracial couple or some different faiths or something. But the reason that movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I think really worked was we were all on the same page instantly because we all relate to that fear.
This could have been, as I sat watching it, Jordan, it could have been a comedy straight out, could have been horror straight out. You combined the two. What was the nexus? Or why the nexus?
You know, I felt like tone was the most important thing in getting this right. And I knew that if it's too funny, it doesn't really it risks not doing justice to the seriousness of the subject matter. If it's too serious, it risks not being a pleasant viewing experience. Mm-hmm. So really, the comedic relief, you know, it's not meant to come in and tell a bunch of jokes. It's meant to give these moments where the audience can feel safe, mm-hmm. where they can feel taken care of, and they can feel the release, because so much of this movie is building the tension, building mm-hmm. the tension. And, you know, I feel like if you're going to do that to an audience, put yeah. an audience through that, yeah. you have to reward them with some safe zones.
I'm glad you said that. The comedy to me wasn't gratuitous. I mean, it was funny, but it's not even fair to call it a comedy. It's funny, but it's only funny because we can see ourselves in those situations.
Right.
We can situate ourselves in those moments, and that's exactly what we would have said,
yep.
what we would have done. So it's only funny in that way. It's not like, did you hear the one about mm-hmm. yada, yada, yada. So it's funny in that sense. Mm-hmm. The other thing to your point about it builds and builds and builds, I'm sitting there again watching this. I'm with you, but it is building and building. You have to, as a director and as a writer, trust that the audience will stay with you and have the patience while you build this thing. Mm-hmm. Why did you think that would work? Because let's face it, most of our attention spans these days are like that. But you forced us to be patient with you.
Well,
you know, I thought was risky.
Well, yeah, it is risky. Yeah. And some of my biggest insecurities about the film were along the lines of, yeah, is the first half of this movie, is it too much of an ask? Because mm-hmm. it is, it's playing off of tension and suspense as more than it's giving us answers or reveals. Yeah. And there is a thing where people like to know what they're getting into mm-hmm. in general when they see a movie. Even if they think they don't,
right.
they like to know. I just looked at some of my favorite movies, The Stepford Wives, Rosemary's Baby. Certainly when you look at other huge films like Blair Witch Project mm-hmm. and Paranormal Activity. These are films that utilized terror, which is the moments, which is before the horror takes place. And it proved to me that you can enrapture an audience with terror. If they know something's coming, if they know and they don't know what it is, they will
I just love that phrase, you can enrapture them with terror. That sounds like Donald Trump.
I was going to say
it. I'm going to enrapture them with terror.
I was going to say it if you didn't.
Yeah,
it's true. Well, you make a good point. And this country, you know, there's a reason that right now in this country, yeah. we are enraptured with terror.
Yeah.
We are afraid. Many of us are very afraid. And but at the same time, it's fascinating to watch this car crash unfold. So this is part of the issue of how we got here as well, is that the sensationalism and the fascination with this over the top
yeah.
personality, administration and movement is partially what perpetuated his ability to sell
yeah.
his brand.
Before I let you go, and speaking yeah. of enrapturing with terror, that closing at the Academy Awards. Talk about being enraptured for 3.5 hours with terror. And then wow. the end, you get the big reveal. What did you, I mean, you're in the business and you may one day be on that stage.
Hey,
what did you make of that thing?
I mean, that was something. I mean, talk about the underdog comes back in the end to win. That is the true Hollywood ending. So I loved that. I thought La La Land was good, mm-hmm. and I think Damien is a talent. I met him, and I think that film deserved the achievements mm-hmm. it got as well. I cannot tell you how happy I was for Moonlight, specifically being about a black man who is gay, the idea that movie has now been exposed to the mainstream through this is such an important achievement.
Yeah,
I'm just so happy for everybody involved.
Yeah, I'll close on this. So you've done this directing thing. Obviously, you've been writing for a while. You've done the directing thing. You did it remarkably well. You're number one. I assume that this is the first of many. Is that where you're headed now? You want to do more directing?
I love
less,
it.
Less acting, or
I
you
love
balance both?
Yeah. yeah. I'm a bigger fan of my directing than
right.
my acting, and acting is just harder. You know, not harder per se, because directing is the hardest thing I've ever had to do, mm-hmm. but it's harder to enjoy my work as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of why this film was so rewarding, is because I got to make one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. Well, we'll enjoy the acting for you.
All right. I love it.
Especially as long as you're doing Key and Peele reruns.
Hey.
Thank you for all those years, man. That's a lot of good stuff there.
Thank you, man.
A whole lot of good stuff. Congrats again, my friend.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the program,
all
Jordan.
Right.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Nicola Benedetti is one of the most sought-after violinists of her generation. Her ability to captivate audiences with her innate musicianship has made her one of the most influential classical artists of today. She joins us now as she wraps up her North American tour.
Nicola, I am honored, finally, to have you on this program.
Thank you so much. It's an honor for me
to meet you. Oh, please, to meet you. It's my great honor to have you here finally. I can thank my friend Wynton Marsalis for making the connection, so thank you.
Thank you to him, yes.
Thank you, Wynton, wherever you are. Because I wanted to talk to you for so long. As a matter of fact, the last time I saw you, you didn't see me, because you're on stage and I'm in the audience, but the last time I saw you was last summer. You were here performing the
violin
concerto,
yes,
that he wrote for you.
At the Hollywood Bowl.
At the Hollywood Bowl, exactly. Great performance.
Thank you.
I read somewhere, or Wynton may have told me, that when he first gave it to you, you told him that it wasn't
difficult enough.
Difficult enough. Yeah. Wasn't complex enough. Is that true?
It's absolutely true.
Okay,
I mean, totally truthful, it was just a first draft of the first movement, of which there are four.
Right.
He says it shocked him because he's used to being told that his music is too complicated and too difficult, and please make this more simple.
Right.
But I'm used to playing violin concertos that are written specifically for many hours of practice to be put into that. And that's where my comfort zone is. It's what I've always done. If I look at a new piece of music, I expect to spend a month playing for 6 hours a day just to get to know the notes, never mind develop your relationship to it and an interpretation. So so for me, I wanted music that was going to force that time connecting myself to the notes and to the experience. So. But I sure got what I asked for in the end. It's not an easy concerto.
So when a classical violinist even ask someone like Wynton to write a piece for them, what are you looking for from him, given his background?
I have known his music since I was a teenager and have many, many of his recordings. Mm-hmm. I know all of the pieces that he's written for larger scale groups, either for his big band or things like Blood on the Fields, the kind of oratorio, but also things like All Rise and the Swing Symphony, where he's combined the jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with a classical symphony orchestra. So I had a lot of context, but I had no idea how that was going to manifest itself in a violin concerto. But Wynton always says that it's an experience for him. Writing a piece is always very personal. He wants it to be something the person is going to like, something the person is going to want to play again and again. So he was very patient and detailed in asking me, what kind of form would you like this piece to take? What do you feel you want to say through a new commission, a new collaboration? As classical musicians, we're 95% of the time playing music that is written by someone we cannot communicate with other than through letters, through music, through written material, something that is a document that we look at. So to have that unique experience, to just have a dialogue with somebody that is creating the music, I mean, it was an experience there's like the me before the writing of that piece and the me after it. It changed me.
Yeah. You said something now that I never thought about before. Since so much of what classical artists play is stuff that was written generations ago, and to your point, these folk have long been since deceased, what is the value of being able to have a conversation with the person who wrote the stuff that you're playing?
I think it cancels so much of the guesswork. And in some ways, what it did for me, not just in the experience of playing Wynton's concerto, but what it changed in me, the experience of playing all of the music that I play, is I could sort of, I stopped looking at composers like not human beings anymore. Mm. You know, I started looking at them more like people, like composers have just, they have whims, and they also feed off a lot of your instrumental ability, how you interpret something, how you feel you would like to play something, and a lot of flexibility. And I think a lot of the time we are looking at composers and sort of obsessing over the tiniest little detail. I mean, Beethoven, for example, you actually look at his writing, look at his scores. He was changing his mind constantly, the mess that we actually interface with when you look at that. I mean, it's just somebody that was and also somebody that was improvising constantly. And this is another thing that I was actually reading one of the latest biographies written of Beethoven around that time. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking a lot about the art of improvisation, and that's something that's largely has disappeared from the classical music, especially all the instrumentalists. Most of us don't improvise.
It's not just disappeared, it's almost heresy if you do that. The peers come after you if you do that.
It is, the disciplines have been separated out so massively, and you look back to the life of Beethoven, and that, I mean, he wasn't even interested in teaching his students pieces that he had written. He was more interested in improvising with them. He would spend hours in lessons just saying, you know, no, try something else, try something new, try something different. I mean, there's a level of acceptance, of course, that that's a discipline you have to start doing from a young age, and I didn't. I was learning, I was, you know, my head buried in the repertoire of Tchaikovsky and Brahms and Beethoven, and that has its own worth and beauty and discipline. But it got me thinking a lot about what the ability to improvise should do to your interpretation, should do to the way that you play in a way that is free to choose where you want to go, when you want to go it, when you want to go there, rather than this very kind of precious preconception of exactly what you want to do before you walk on the stage.
I ask that because I wonder how much differently we would hear what we hear when we go to concert halls if the persons playing it had a chance to talk to Beethoven or Bach or Brahms or Tchaikovsky. I wonder if what we hear in the way they play might be different if they could talk to the actual composer.
I think a level of naturalness, a level of risk-taking, a level of, at the moment, I'm on tour with Venice Baroque Orchestra, and these guys, they specialize, obviously, in Italian Baroque repertoire, but that's one of the things that they have captured and brought to life again, is this sense of here and now, let's just try this, let's just try that. They are so free as musicians, and I think a lot of our environment, although I'm never one of those musicians to complain about the beauty of the silence and the focus and the concentration that's within a classical music concert hall. I think it's one of the most precious things to experience on both sides. But in saying that, there is an element of tension and a lack of just normal human interaction that I think is sometimes we suffer a little bit from that.
I'm honored to have had you on this program for this conversation.
Thank
now
you.
I got to shut up, make room for the performance. Stand by as Nicola closes with the Venice Baroque Orchestra and a performance of Chaconne in B flat major by Vivaldi. Did I get that right?
Perfect.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.